in modern America, our conception of a democracy is, of course, that the will of all should govern. When you take every selfish individual voting and then you add up the net result, then you decide what to do. But Rousseau, that was not his concept of democracy. I was beginning to say we have certain health care proposals being given, and it's amazing to me when you see people interviewed, and it's frightening too, it ought to be frightening to you, not just what they are saying, but the nature of what they are saying. Over and over and over again, the response is both favorable and unfavorable. Okay, so I'm not taking sides here. But the responses are based on what? How it will affect me. Will I pay more? Will I get better coverage for less? No one stops to ask, what is moral? What is right? What, according to our political theory or our social theory, is appropriate for the government to do about health care? But it's, will I get more? Will I get less? Will I be paying more or less? From a doctor's standpoint, is this going to improve or is it going to be contrary to my financial well-being? Rousseau would say, and I agree with him here, it's a minimal agreement, Rousseau would say that is not relevant in a democratic society. A democratic society should be governed by the general will, not the will of all selfish individuals adding up their votes, but the general will. The general will, he said, is the majority as it is concerned with the welfare of the whole nation. When the majority vote out of a concern for the welfare of the whole nation, then the result of that is called the general will. Because everybody is looking out for everybody else when we vote, then we can count on the outcome to be for everybody's good. And when you have the general will operating, and somebody says, no, I don't want to go along with that, I'm going to be an individual, I'm going to fight against that, Rousseau says, then we will compel him to be free. And that's because he doesn't realize that what the majority has chosen is in his best interest. He has a different opinion than them, but of course, if he understood that men are basically good and the majority are voting for what's in everyone's best interest, he's not going to be free by standing against the majority. To me, as a philosopher, it's always been fascinating. I don't agree with Rousseau's social philosophy. And of course, you can see the naivete of this. Well, democracy will work on the basis of the general will, not the will of all, but the general will. Well, but you can only believe in the general will if you first of all believe what? That men are innocent, basically good, will only look out for the will of the nation and the good, the benefit of the nation, and not their own. But I know better about human nature and so forth, so I don't like his social philosophy. But for all of that, the irony is Rousseau has put his finger on an interesting, maybe some people would consider it paradox, and that is that it is true that the individual is not free if he's only an individual. I think I can illustrate this because I've raised children and I've taken, you know, groups of children places. Let's say you're in a nice big station wagon or a minivan and your car is full of 8-year-olds. Yeah. Okay, so you've got, you've really packed them in. 10 8-year-olds in this car with you. Okay, and as you're going along, either down the road in the car or where you stop to get something to eat or at the museum or whatever it is, you have 9 of the 8-year-olds who want to do something in particular or engage in a certain kind of activity, and 1 who is in a really bad mood will not get along with anybody. Okay, and so this one individual 8-year-old says, well, if you're not going to do what I want to do in the car, you can just let me out. Now stop and think about this. Is Rousseau correct? Will he really be free if he's given his individuality at that point? Would you be so stupid going down the highway to say an 8-year-old who doesn't want to sing the same songs with the rest of the kids or get along with them should just be put out on the highway? No, it is true that you will force him to be free. You will say, you'll sit in your spot and you'll stop smacking the person next to you because everyone will be happier, and if everyone is happier, then you will be happier. What if we allowed all the 8-year-olds to be their own little selfish individuals, smacking one another, doing different things, not getting along in the car? Is anybody free now? No, because it turns out you can't pursue the things you want to do because you live in an environment that's so hostile. And what all I'm commending Rousseau for here is that he did recognize there's a sense in which those people who stand outside the general will are not really free. They are hurting themselves. Now, I don't believe that insight justifies the state coming in an authoritarian way, saying, we will force you to be free. Because you know what you create then? You create what's called a paternalistic state, a state that acts like a father, paternalistic. So the father in the car says, Johnny, you stop doing that or I'm going to spank you. I will force you to be free. A state that is paternalistic is a state that starts making decisions for people and tyrannizing them and taking away their freedom in the name of what? Their own good. I don't wish to be pointed. No, I do wish to be pointed. Is that not the problem that we're facing in the United States of America right now? The state butting into everything paternalistically to force us to do what's in our best interest? The state doesn't believe there's a realm for freedom where people can make, in fact, bad decisions and learn from those decisions. But the point is everybody can make his own decisions. Rather, we'll come in and we'll make the decisions for you. We will, to use Rousseau's phrase, force you to be free. According to Rousseau, and I quote, the people are never corrupted, though often deceived. The people are never corrupted, though often deceived. If in a democracy you find that people are not pursuing the general will, but instead the will of all, it's not because they're corrupt, it's because they haven't been educated well. So again, what's the answer? How do you make a democracy work properly? Make sure everybody's educated properly. And there we again, that's the spirit of America. Get people the right education, and then we'll have a good functioning democracy. Well, the views of Rousseau influenced this document, the Declaration of the Rights of Man, 1789. The Declaration of the Rights of Man, of course, is the stepping stone to the French Revolution. I want to say one more word about Rousseau's religious views. Rousseau promoted a religion of the heart, quote unquote. A religion of the heart. He said, the more I strive to prove God rationally, the less I understand of God. That is, the more I rest on reason, the further I get away from God. The more I strive to prove God rationally, the less I understand of Him. And yet, I feel that God exists. And that feeling is adequate for religion. And so this is a religion of the heart, a religion of sentiment, a religion of feeling, rather than a religion that is rational or based on reason. In fact, religion, he says, owes nothing to any particular creed, tradition, or culture. This, too, is an important claim. He is saying that religion, if you will, generic religion, is found everywhere. He is a cultural relativist then. Hindu religion, Muslim religion, Buddhist religion, Taoist religion, Roman Catholic religion, Protestant religion, no matter what you find, at base they are all the same underlying feeling or sentiment. Religion owes nothing to a particular creed or a particular culture or a particular tradition. Religion is the underlying universal feeling of the heart. And this is highly significant, you know, in future developments and events in Western history, because people no longer think we have to debate the truth of this creed against that creed, because we really underneath all have the same religion. It's just, it comes to different expression. Okay? So religion is this all-rational, I won't say anti-rational, but it has nothing to do with reason, this all-rational sentiment of the heart, which then comes to rational expression in different places and times, in different creeds, a religion of the heart, a view that was very significant with Immanuel Kant, and later the German Goethe. Okay, so Rousseau is a turn from the rationalism of the Enlightenment to a romantic outlook on life. In the last entry in your outline for Enlightenment movements, we've seen England and Scotland and France. We move over to Germany and consider the Aufklärung, the Enlightenment. As we look at the German Aufklärung, or Enlightenment, or you might say the German version of deism, we see two general tendencies. First, an optimism regarding reason controlling human life. Optimism regarding reason being the guide and control of human life. And then secondly, the idea that we gain illumination by reason and are emancipated from prejudices and authority. The illuminating effect of reason as it emancipates us from prejudice and from authority. I want to mention three German Enlightenment Aufklärung writers real quickly. First of all, Hermann Reimarus. Reimarus, Reimarus, 1694 to 1768. We look at Reimarus, or Reimarus, however you want to say it, and the German Enlightenment, because it particularly has an influence on the history of theology and biblical studies. For my money, the English deists are more interesting and so forth, but the history of theology seems to be more influenced by the continental or European Enlightenment. And Hermann Reimarus, particularly, is known because he wrote a critique of Christianity from a deist perspective in the year 1774. A critique of Christianity from a deist perspective entitled Apology for or Defense of the Rational Worshipper of God. Apology for or Defense of the Rational Worshipper of God. Well, once again, the title tells you everything you need to know. Here's a man whose apologetic is for rational religion. Well, that means the miracles of Jesus and other elements of the Bible come under scrutiny and are rejected. Another German Enlightenment thinker I want you to recognize, Gotthold Lessing, Lessing, 1729 to 1781. Lessing had a broad literary career. A many accomplishments in different fields of writing. It was his view that the power of religion depends on its ministering to the human spirit, regardless of all speculative views or all creeds. What's important or what's powerful in religion is how it ministers to the human spirit. Now, what are we getting when Rousseau tells us it's not creed that's important, it's sentiment? What are we getting when Lessing tells us it's not the speculation of religion, but the ministration of religion that's important? We're getting a dichotomy being drawn again where religion is, as Schaeffer will call it, an upper story kind of experience. In the nature of the case, religion has nothing to do with rationality, speculation, creeds, or truths. Religion is a matter of feeling. According to Lessing, goodness is no respecter of creeds. That you can be a Hindu, you can be a Buddhist, you can be a Christian, you can be a Protestant, you can be a Roman Catholic. And you'll find among all these groups people that are basically good. Well, isn't that the view of our day and age? You wouldn't dare, you know, it'd be politically incorrect. You wouldn't dare in the mass media or on TV want to make a remark against the ethic of somebody's creed. The only thing that really matters, people say, is are you a good neighbor? Are you a nice guy? And there are nice guys, you see, among the atheists. There are nice guys among the Christians, nice guys among the Jews, nice guys among the Arabs, nice guys among the Hindus, nice guys among the Buddhists. Again, I'm overdrawing the picture, but am I right? In our day and age, the only thing that counts is whether, you know, you live a decent life. You're a nice guy. Well, this was the view of Lessing. Goodness is no respecter of creeds. And therefore, we should tolerate all creeds. There shouldn't be discrimination against any religious or philosophical outlook. Because what's important is not your theory, but what? Whether you're a nice guy, whether you have a good life. And here we have the ghost of David Hume again, although this is the same general period as Hume's life. They're pursuing a view that's on parallel tracks, if you will. Hume says you can't know about theory. Reason won't give you the truth. The only thing that counts is what? Pragmatism. How you live your life. And in that sense, Lessing is a religious pragmatist. I don't care about the theories, the creeds that people have. The only thing that counts is whether they're good. Goodness is no respecter of creeds. In 1780, he published perhaps his most important philosophical work, The Education of the Human Race. You know what would happen to somebody today if they published a book with that title? How presumptuous, how arrogant we think today. But in his day and age, you could do something like that. I mean, here was this overweening pride in reason, The Education of the Human Race. According to him, every religion has contributed something to human development. Every religion has contributed something to human development, and there is a law of progress at work in history. There is a law of progress at work in history. Things are getting better and better and better. By the way, when evangelical Christians react against any kind of optimistic view of history, you'll often find that they're really reacting against this kind of prideful, autonomous enlightenment view that in history there's a natural law of progress. Well, Lessing held to that, but that is not anything like what I think biblical postmillennialism teaches, which isn't based on the basic goodness of man, but the power and sovereignty of God who promises to bring the nations under the rule of his Son. All right, Lessing says there's a law of progress in history which is bringing us to a stage of a new eternal gospel. A new eternal gospel. Now, what do you think this gospel is going to be like, given what I've already told you? Well, it's obviously going to be that religious sentiment and goodness that's universal, that all religions have. a stage, the new eternal gospel, where men seek the right, not out of rewards, but just because it is right. Men are getting better and better. There's progress in history, and the day will come when men will do the right thing, not because they're bribed with rewards or threatened with punishment, but just because it's right. They will do the right for right's sake. Now, you need to get that in your notes, because that is very influential with Immanuel Kant. When Immanuel Kant writes his moral theory, he will maintain that the good man does what is right, not because it will have good consequences, but simply because it is right. He does his duty for duty's sake. Just because it's his duty, just because it's right, he does it. Lessing was also influential in the life of Soren Kierkegaard. We'll get to him in our next unit of this class, the Danish existentialist writer. The last German Enlightenment person I'll mention is Immanuel Kant. And I just want to give you a little taste of Kant, because we're going to have a whole section of lecture on him coming up. Kant was part of the German Enlightenment, and he said that the motto of Enlightenment is dare to reason. Get that in your notes. It's real short. Dare to reason. That's the motto of the Enlightenment, Kant said. You are free. You are a free being. So manage your freedom not by religious tutelage, but by reason. Dare to reason. Be a free man. Don't be in the shackles of religious creeds. Manage your freedom by means of your own reason. Dare to reason. Well, by going over all these different Enlightenment movements, as I've called them in the outline, apart from the Scottish common sense realist school that is contemporary with these things, I hope that looking at English deism, Voltaire, the encyclopedist, the sensationalist, materialist, Rousseau's romanticism, and the German dare to reason Enlightenment views, that you have picked up a sense of the mood of this period, the general outlook and thrust of the Age of Reason, as it's often called, the Age of Reason. Roman numeral 24 in our outline is a discussion of the loss of optimism regarding reason. The loss of optimism regarding reason. And we'll be picking this up tomorrow, but just let me preview for you where we're going. I'll rehearse in A, in your outline, what this optimism of the Enlightenment was all about regarding the rationality of the universe and man, and be giving you some illustrations of that and give you some detail of what this optimism is all about. And then I want to talk about the collapse of this optimism through certain social events, and especially the philosophy of David Hume. The skepticism of Hume and things like the French Revolution just gutted the optimism of the Enlightenment. Then we'll recap the period. I'll go over the development from Hobbes down to Hume for you again, and then point out in D that we've moved from a very confident attitude about reason now to a despair regarding rationality. Hume says reason can't tell you anything, it turns out. That's your imagination and the operations of your mind. And this opens the door then, you know, in the mitigated skepticism of Hume, to a very deprecating view of reason. But before we can go on to the depressing results in the 19th century, we have to notice that there was one person left standing in the German Enlightenment who thought that he could save reason from the onslaught of David Hume's skepticism. That was Immanuel Kant, and that's why I have in your notes Kant to the rest.